Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, reaching for the stars. This year's Templeton Prize winner says scientists and theologians should cooperate more closely together to probe the mysteries of our universe. Life on the ocean waves. The International Labour Organization comes up with a new convention on safer working conditions in the maritime industry. And the church, young people and the media. Are Europe's church leaders up to date with the latest ways of communicating the faith? Welcome to the programme. He's considered an expert on nothingness and infinity. He's written books, plays and lectures for young and old alike, and he's given talks at venues including the Venice Film Festival, No. 10 Downing Street, and here in the Vatican. He is British cosmologist and maths professor Dr. John Barrow, who's been awarded this year's Templeton Prize for Progress in Understanding Between Science and Religion. Given annually, this award is the largest individual monetary prize, worth more than the Nobel Awards, to highlight the importance of research into spiritual subject matters. The 53-year-old Dr. Barrow is married with a family, lives and works in Cambridge, where he lectures in applied maths, but also directs a project aimed at children as young as 5 years old. He says he's somewhat surprised at being honoured with this prestigious award.
This prize in the past tends to go to people who are a good deal older than me. Although it has gone to physicists fairly often, actually, in recent years. So, yes, a surprise.
Now, I know that you're a cosmologist, a professor at Cambridge University, who has developed, and I quote, multidisciplinary perspectives on subjects such as the mysteries of nothingness and infinity. Now, to a layperson like myself, that means very, very little. Can you just explain in a few words, if you can, what exactly is your specific area of study?
I'm a cosmologist, so I use mathematics and physics to study the large-scale structure of the universe today and to try to reconstruct its past history, and in so doing try to understand why it has certain properties that it displays today. So what shape it is, why it contains galaxies and little variations from one direction to another. And I use mathematical physics. I'm a theorist primarily. I have observed in the past to try to reconstruct the history of the universe and understand how it got to be as it is today. One of the problems I'm interested in at the moment is whether those quantities, which are usually called the constants of nature, are really constant, or whether they might be very, very slowly changing over billions of years. And it turns out that astronomy is a much better way to investigate that question than doing experiments in a laboratory. Because if you catch the light that comes from the most distant objects in the universe, it's been travelling to us for more than 10 billion years. And so if you look at the information that the light is telling you about what the laws of physics and the constants of nature were like at the moment when the light left the quasar or distant galaxy, you can compare it with the situation here and now in the laboratory and see whether something has changed over that 10 billion year travel time. So that's an example of the sort of research work I'm engaged in at the moment. The mentions in that statement about nothing and the infinite, they relate to two books that I wrote in recent years. One was called The Book of Nothing. It's published in Italian as From Zero to Infinity. And it's about the whole history and present situation with regard to the concept of nothing in different subjects. So in mathematics, this is the story of zero, you know, how the zero symbol came to be invented, and then in philosophy, how people became happy with the idea that nothing could be something. In theology, the idea of creation out of nothing. And then in physics, the idea of the vacuum and the void. And in astronomy, quantum physics, today people have discovered the nature of the quantum vacuum, whether the universe could be a fluctuation out of the quantum vacuum, something called the inflationary universe, which exploits the fact that the universe can sort of change from one vacuum state to another, and in so doing, its expansion will surge in some way that has interesting consequences. So this subject was chosen because it plays a pivotal and interesting role in all these different disciplines. And similarly with the subject of infinity, again, there's an interesting story from the world of mathematics, from physics, from theology, from philosophy, and even from literature.
Now, you mentioned these different disciplines, including, of course, religion, and you've been given this award because of your work exploring, if you like, the interface between science and religion. Tell us when you first really became interested in this particular sphere of work.
Well, I think the interest in my work is, in effect, that people who work professionally in theology or at the interface between science and religion have become very interested in developments that have taken place in cosmology and other related areas of science and mathematics. So my work provides a sort of raw material, really, for those people to stimulate new discussion, new developments in their special area of interest. So cosmology is one of those subjects which has always been of major interest, obviously to people in a number of subjects, including theology as well as astronomy. So there's a natural interest in the same sorts of questions. You know, did the universe have a beginning? Will it have an end? Is it finite? Is it infinite? So I'd always been interested in those questions right from the time I began studying and working in astronomy.
Of course, it's also true to say that in the past, scientists were seen more often as enemies of religion rather than allies in these kind of studies. And today there's still a lot of antagonism often between scientists and theologians. What do you think can be done perhaps to encourage the cooperation rather than conflict on these issues?
Well, there's obviously a need for a sort of mutual educational activity. I mean, for people to understand more fully the questions that others are asking. One could imagine, for example, in seminaries and other colleges where ministers of religion are trained, they ought to receive some instruction in science. It's not normally the case. It might be in some particular institutions where they happen to have some expertise. But it's clearly important, I think, for ministers of religion to have some education in what are the key issues in science of the day, what sort of questions might people ask you in these areas. So I think there's a need for education at that level. And there's also need for some educational activity in the other direction. And I know some organizations are already piloting programs of this sort, where perhaps scientists who have some interest in religious questions are able to develop a more serious knowledge of the scholarship that's gone on the theological side about these sorts of questions. So to move them on from just having a sort of amateur interest and just recognizing that there are questions which theologians might be interested in, to try to move them on to the next level of having an in-depth appreciation of what sort of debate, what sort of questions are being asked by people in theology and philosophy. Next month, I'm in fact coming to the Vatican for a short conference on new questions in the philosophy of science that's being organized by the Gregorian University. And I think this meeting has one of these aims in mind, to try to discover new questions that might be of interest for philosophy and philosophical theology that are emerging out of current research in cosmology and other science.
So you're saying there is really a growing climate of cooperation and mutual interest in the other side, if you like, in areas where people were often not taken perhaps very seriously if scientists showed some kind of interest in religious theories.
Yes, I think there's been a major development of this interface over the last 10 years. At Oxford, for example, you know, there's now a professorship in science and religion, the Idris Chair in Cambridge, a new institute was just created called the Faraday Institute to study the interface between science and religion. I believe there's a new professorship at Harvard. So in many major universities, this subject is recognized as being of considerable current interest. And also, I think there's problems of a sort of interfaith dialogue, particularly between the Islamic and the Christian world. The common interest in science is a very interesting unifying factor. Both those traditions have strong interest in science. The scientists involved generally know one another quite well, and the people who are interested in science and religion from both faith traditions also know each other quite well. So it's a very good opportunity for interfaith dialogue as well as a science-religion dialogue.
Can I ask you, do you have any particular faith background of your own that has influenced you at all in this work that you do?
We're members of the United Reformed Church in the UK, which you probably know was created as a merger of the Presbyterian Congregationalist denominations back in the early 1970s. In America, those two denominations would still be separate, but in the UK, they joined together, along with a number of other smaller denominations in the Reformed tradition.
You're also described as a highly educated scholar with a knack for the common touch. Now, isn't it fair to say that it's hard to make these scientific concepts really accessible, perhaps, to the man or woman on the street?
Yes, I mean, part of my job at Cambridge, half my time I'm a research professor in mathematics, cosmology, and the other half I direct a public education program in mathematics and all its applications. That's to science, to business, to sport, to any other engineering, any other area of application of mathematics. And that work is directed at the general public, it's directed at school teachers, and it's directed at school students from age 5 up to 18. And lots of that activity is done via the internet, via websites, video conferencing, but we also do a lot of live lectures and other interactive activities. So I'm engaged in a lot of public understanding work in science. I hold the Gresham Professorship in Astronomy at the moment, which is one of the oldest professorships of science in the world, if not the oldest. But nowadays it's dedicated to giving lectures to the general public in London on several occasions a year. So I do a lot of lecturing to general audiences in the UK and around the world, quite a lot in Italy. And as you may know, I wrote this play Infinities that was performed by the Teatro Piccolo in Milan on two separate years a few years ago, directed by Luca Ronconi. So I have engaged in a lot of public understanding activity for young people and for not so young people.
British cosmologist and Cambridge professor John Barrow is the 2006 Templeton Prize winner for Progress in Understanding Between Science and Religion. Now from the distant stars to the high seas, as the International Labour Organization comes up with a new treaty to ensure safer working conditions for the world's seafarers. Life on the ocean waves can be a pretty tough existence for the 1.25 million people who work in the maritime industry. Often they spend months away at sea, in cramped and unhealthy conditions, doing dangerous jobs for long shifts with no protection or rights. But now the International Labour Organization has come up with a new treaty to protect seafarers from exploitation in difficult and dangerous working conditions. The treaty, known as the Consolidated Maritime Labour Convention, was approved and ratified by many of the ILO's 178 member nations in Geneva recently. It's been hailed as a breakthrough after 5 years of negotiations between shipowners, seafarers' unions and governments which will be affected by the legislation. Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, which includes the ILO. He told me why this agreement is so significant.
This convention, called the Maritime Labour Convention 2006, is a very important document that is going to change the life of seafarers to a large degree, making it a better life in terms of work and protection, security, health. It's a combination of some 30 conventions already approved in the past 80 years and some 30 recommendations of the ILO conference. And the combination of these agreed rules combined with some new additions that modernize and update the whole standard system for the life of people working on board ships, I think is going to be a step that for a long time will remain very effective and very helpful for the 1,200,000 workers in this sector of the industry.
Now, you talk about the maritime industry as the world's first global industry, don't you? And the convention is responding to this, isn't it?
Yes, the maritime industry by its very nature is a global network of shipping lines going from one corner of the world to another. And they link up employers, workers, the need of trade, and since the seafarers that are the backbone of this industry are coming from more and more from a variety of countries, from the Philippines or from Latin America or from Africa, and the crews are all mixed up, and they go from one port to another of one continent or the other, there is a need to have some standards, some rules that are valid everywhere. So in all the ports where these people end up, they find that there is the same type of protection. In this sense, the maritime industry is a very visible globalized industry, and therefore there was a felt need to provide it with standards and rules that are equally applicable all over the world.
Now, it's fair to say that many of these people working in the maritime industry work in pretty terrible conditions at the moment, don't they?
The reason for pushing forward and now to encourage a quick ratification on the part of states of this new instrument, juridical instrument. The reason is exactly because there is a need to improve the conditions of life of seafarers, especially on board ships. Now, with the new technology that is facilitating maritime transport, there is very little time, for example, for seafarers to go ashore when they are in port, because the turnover is so quick, they have very little chance to take some time off. Secondly, on board itself, sometimes the rooms are inadequate, the small cubicles where they sleep are very inadequate, or they don't have work schedules that are flexible or that they are excessively long. And the convention is looking at all these practical and day-to-day dimension of the work of these seafarers.
In other words, the companies involved are much more interested in profits than they are in the people actually working on their ships.
The maritime industry is very competitive. And therefore, companies obviously are looking for the way to save money, to make a profit, and to keep going. But what is I find interesting is that the ship owners are participating in this convention. They have been negotiating in a very open and fair way. And even on the most difficult issues, there has been an effort to arrive at a consensus between the tripartite players in the preparation of this convention, governments, workers, and employers. So I would say that a significant signal that this convention sends out is that through dialogue and a mutual effort to safeguard the interest of everybody, it's possible to arrive at decent documents that are going to favor and provide decent work for people.
Now, the Catholic Church has been concerned with the life and the difficulties that seafarers face for many years, hasn't it? There are a number of organizations that have been working alongside these people, trying to provide for their pastoral, their spiritual needs, as well as providing and supporting their rights.
That is very correct. For decades, the church or church people have been involved, especially through port facilities that give welcome and make the short time that seafarers stay on land a home away from home. The Catholic Church has been active through the Apostleship of the Sea, present in over 100 countries. And then there is a Federation of Christian organizations active on behalf of seafarers. It's called the International Christian Maritime Association, or ICMA, with over 500 social centers around the globe that become points of reference for seafarers in need of assistance or counsel, or even if there is an emergency, for some kind of protection. So the witness of the Christian community and of the Catholic Church in particular is a sign that for the people who are more exposed to a tough life or to dangerous conditions or to a more difficult and isolated existence away from home, the church wants to be there and to be of some assistance.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the UN in Geneva, which includes the International Labour Organization. And finally, the church, young people, and the media. To many, it's a source of great concern to see kids spending so many hours in front of their computer screens or plugged into iPods and similar listening devices. Yet to those working in the church's media offices, it represents one of the greatest challenges they face: how to reach those young people and make the gospel message sound relevant to their lives today. Jim McDonnell is Director of Advocacy for Cygnus, the World Catholic Communications Network, and former advisor to the Vatican's Council for Social Communications. He recently attended a meeting of the European Bishops' Media Commission here in Rome, discussing ways of using modern communications technology more effectively, a task he describes as something of an uphill struggle.
I would say it's a task that has to be constantly renewed, because what happens is you have waves in which perhaps certain bishops become very interested or really understand what the issues are, but then of course they may die or they may move on or the jobs may change, and you have to, as it were, continually evangelize the bishops about the importance of media. So it's a sort of never-ending story. But I think there is a broader recognition now in the European Church that we do have to take the media seriously. I think the real issue is we're not quite sure what that means in terms of actual concrete actions.
Is a lot of your focus now on the new technologies, on computer technology, rather than traditional forms of radio, television, cinema, and so on?
I think there's a general recognition that the new forms of media, and especially the exponential growth of the internet and the development of technologies and services associated with that, are changing the way in which people are using media in Europe. And so the traditional forms, radio and television, though they're still important, even they're changing the way they're being delivered. And we have to think about what are the ways to reach people and where are people spending their time. There was a study just recently in England which showed that younger age groups now are spending far more of their time with the internet than they are with television, traditional television. And even as technology is developing, a lot of those people will be actually watching their television on the computer screen.
This means also investing money, doesn't it, in different and newer areas. This is also, I imagine, a subject for discussion at this meeting.
Yes, I think in terms of investment in money, the general recognition is that there isn't very much money to invest. So there is this problem that you need to have money. But I think a bigger problem is you need to have the people who understand the new world of these technologies, and they understand the new contexts, so they can actually come up with ways of communicating that will reach people. There's no point in just pumping a lot of money into something if it turns out that very few people are watching or very few people are listening. And one of the good things about the new technologies is that they are relatively inexpensive to create product for the internet. But what is expensive in a sense is the time you need to spend in working out what you need to be developing and how you're going to ensure that the people you want to reach actually know it's there.
You mentioned, of course, young people who are the key users of these new technologies in particular. One looks at the perhaps older faces of the bishops at a meeting like this and asks the question, how many people who you're really trying to serve are actually involved in these kind of decisions that you're making?
Well, this is recognised. There was a meeting last year in Warsaw which looked precisely at this issue about young people, media and church. And there were various interventions by younger people who made it quite clear that this was their world and their universe and that perhaps other people weren't so familiar with it. The difficulty is finding those people and encouraging them and, in a sense, trusting them to do it. And I think that could be a big challenge because it means, in many cases, the church, in a sense, having to let go and let people find their way in this new world and trusting them to come up with the right solutions.
What is your message to this meeting, then, from the experience that you've had, both of the new medias but also the more traditional methods?
Well, I think it's the same message that came out actually at the end of the meeting that we had last year in Warsaw, which was, don't be afraid of the media and don't be afraid of the new media. Let's not lose our nerve at this point, but let's keep going forward and try one way or another to find ways of connecting with young people. But that means finding ways to bring younger people into the process of communicating and decision-making within the churches.
Jim McDonald there is Director of Advocacy for Cygnus, the World Catholic Communications Network. And that's all from us here at the English programme for today. We'll be back, of course, on the air at this same time tomorrow. Be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget you can always find our programmes on the internet at 105live.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.